Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, what if we've all been bracing for a recession that never actually shows up? That's a question that's floating around more and more these days as the economy just keeps hanging in there. Despite the rapid rise in interest rates, a few bank failures, and all the dire predictions that came along with both of those. We'll get into it with a well-known economist at a major Wall Street bank. But first, Valdana, I've got a very strange question for you.
I'm shocked.
You're shocked?
Yeah.
I've never asked you a strange question. Have you ever daydreamed about like being a princess or a queen?
No.
Or royalty? You haven't?
No.
Oh, well, that's a healthy outlook.
Yeah. It's not real. And they like didn't have bathrooms.
There are real princesses. And
oh, that's true. Like modern day.
Do you think... The current princesses and princes? Prince Harry doesn't have a modern bathroom?
He definitely does, but like, are they beloved by their people, you know? It comes with a lot of baggage.
All right. Well, that's a healthy attitude.
Why are you asking?
Well, it's my craziest thing this week has to do with, there's actually a market for royal titles, if you believe it or not.
Wow.
So I'll get
into
it.
I would buy one.
You would? All right.
I would be the highest bidder.
Oh, good.
We're
going to find out how much you're willing to pay.
Okay, I don't want to keep our guest waiting because, and I actually just told him this right before we started taping, I'm a huge fan of his. I've been a fan for years, and I'm so excited to
like
have him.
Like you got
on the podcast.
Posters on the wall and stuff?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. No, not to that extreme. It's Seth Carpenter. He's the Global Chief Economist at Morgan Stanley. Seth, thank you so much for joining us.
Bill Donna, thank you. Mike, thanks for having me. I'm glad that this is audio only because I would have blushed. Given what you just said.
Oh, I'm blushing. Don't worry.
He's also a former rider of the Princeton Dinky as well.
I know. Right? Yes. Yeah. He got his PhD at Princeton.
My weird hobby is I love the Princeton Dinky. I don't know why, but I find it fascinating that there's a one car train that goes a mile back and forth every day.
And you can have your tall guy on it. Or what's it called? A tall guy?
A tall boy.
Tall boy.
Yes. You couldn't even finish a tall boy in the time it takes to
get back and forth. Okay, but Seth, you have a very decorated resume. So I'm hoping we can just start out. You can tell us about your background and then how you ended up at Morgan Stanley.
How did I get to where I am? You started off noting that I have a PhD in economics, and I'm happy to say that my primary advisor was Ben Bernanke, who, when I was at Princeton, did not have a Nobel Prize, and now he does. So maybe I had something to do with that.
I would say so.
No, that was actually a fantastic opportunity. And I actually thought I was going to be an academic. My research was on monetary policy, but I went to teach for a couple of years at the College of William and Mary. And then the Fed called and said, are you interested in coming up to do an interview? And the answer was yes. And they offered me a job and I took it. And shocking news for anybody who's in their late 20s. Washington, D.C. is a bit more interesting to live in than Williamsburg, Virginia. So I ended up staying in Washington, D.C. And I was at the Fed for 15 years. By the time I left, I was the deputy director of the Division of Monetary Affairs. Got to work through the financial crisis, which, you know, was a terrible point in economic history. But now that it's in the rearview mirror, it sort of was fascinating part of my career to be at the Fed in the trenches, trying to work on both strategy for policy and then the nitty gritty, like all of the different lending programs the Fed did and thinking about the Fed balance sheet. I was for a while the Fed's person in charge of the Fed's balance sheet, if you will. So it was fascinating, but at some point I needed a break. I went to the Treasury Department ostensibly for just a 1-year visit. But while I was there, I had the very good fortune of having President Obama nominate me to be Assistant Secretary for Financial Markets. So I resigned from the Fed and got to work at the Treasury Department. And I have to say that was a fantastic job. But I did that until 2016. And then I went to the private sector, to financial markets, worked for a year at a hedge fund, worked for 4 years at a different bank. And now I'm happy to say I am the global chief economist here at Morgan Stanley. And I couldn't be happier.
I guess you did have to buy a new wardrobe when you moved to Washington, though, Seth. You couldn't walk around in those colonial uniforms anymore. Like,
pinstripe suit with a tri-corner hat.
To get back to what I was saying in the introduction, my impression is that you are sort of leaning into the soft landing camp these days, thinking that perhaps, fingers crossed, knock on wood and all that, we actually might be able to avoid a recession. Walk us through how you're thinking about that. You know, what's changed to make you a little bit less worried about recession?
Absolutely. We've actually been in the soft landing camp for a while. There were definitely times when everyone in markets was throwing rocks and sticks at us and saying that we're crazy because it was clear we'd get a recession. And then the data for January and February came in that looked a lot better. And people were telling us that we were crazy, that we were still calling for a big slowdown. And now the world has shifted again. What is our thinking? The first thing is that it seems hard to avoid the fact that the U.S. economy is going to slow down. And part of the reason why that's hard to avoid is because that is absolutely categorically the Fed's objective, right? The reason they will keep hiking interest rates at least a bit more is because they want the economy to slow down a lot in order to have inflationary pressures abate. So the slowdown part should be pretty easy to get on board with. So what about the missing the recession part? Well, partly because the slowdown is the Fed's choice, at least having a chance to avoid a recession should also be the Fed's choice. And we think they're looking carefully at the data and asking, do we have enough evidence that things are slowing down a lot, but not yet crashing, because that's what they're looking for in order to stop the hiking cycle. So we think the last hike is in May, when there'll be more evidence of more of a slowdown, but not yet evidence that things have actually fallen off of a cliff. And then I think the last part of our thesis is usually what takes in the US to get a recession is some shock or something that causes the slowdown. So we've got that. But you also need an amplification mechanism. So the economy slows down and businesses lay off millions of workers and their lack of income causes a slump in spending, or you get a big credit crunch and everything seizes up. Both of those are clearly possible, but we don't think they are imminent. For the labor side of things, the job market still seems pretty healthy. The unemployment rate is very low. And if you kind of look at how much employment do we have relative to the level of GDP, you'd come away with the conclusion that, boy, businesses are still a little shorthanded. But what that means is the economy can slow down and businesses don't have to do the same wave of firing that they've had to do in previous slowdowns. So that makes us feel a little bit better. And even though there's clearly tighter funding conditions for banks and banks are pulling back on their lending, especially given what's happened in the wake of all of the banking turmoil, we got to remember that things were already slowing down. Loan growth was already slowing before we got these new sensational headlines about the banking sector turmoil. And because we were sure the economy was going to be slowing down anyway, the demand for that borrowing is going to be following. And so we don't think any pullback by banks and their willingness to lend is going to be the thing that tips us over to recession. So not a super rosy outlook. We are looking for growth that's below 0.5% in real terms, so very, very close to zero. But importantly, we are not looking for a full-blown recession where we have several months in a row of contraction.
Okay, so Seth, you mentioned tighter funding conditions, and I'm wondering where else you are looking to see signs of that now that we've had the bank turmoil. Been, what, a month since that happened. I know I was reading some notes from some of the big banks, and a couple of them actually mentioned Fastenal, some of the warnings from that company, and that company being such a bellwether. So where else are you looking maybe for signs of tighter funding conditions?
So we're trying to look as broadly and as deeply as we possibly can. You can look at things like delinquency rates and deterioration of credit quality on credit cards and that kind of lending to customers. But I, you know, close to home for a big chunk of my career, the Federal Reserve has their senior loan officer opinion survey. They have a survey of terms of business lending. And there they ask lots of banks, what's going on with your lending? And I think that's another really key source of information about willingness to lend by creditors.
Yeah, Seth, I wonder, everybody was kind of bracing for, if not a credit crunch, definitely some kind of credit slowdown after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank failed. Was the emergency term lending facility that was introduced and the discount window at the Fed opened wide, was that enough to basically prevent that type of contagion from that type of nervousness among banks to rein in lending, do you think, or is it something else?
So that's a great question, and it's really hard to know what the counterfactual would have been. But then when you start to look into the details, there wasn't, at least in the first week, that much that went through that new term lending facility, about $12 billion or so. A huge amount went to the FDIC's bridge banks. There's also a fair amount based on First Republic's own public disclosures that went directly there. And so, you know, my initial reading, perhaps through some slightly rose-colored glasses, was that the situation based on that borrowing was more idiosyncratic than systemic. Now, there's still a lot of borrowing from many banks, and the amount going through that term facility has actually edged up a bit over time. It has not fallen. So we don't want to be complacent. But my initial read was that it was more idiosyncratic than systemic. And so as a result, yeah, I suspect that the lending was there, took care of some of the institutions that critically need it. Others, as we know, or have been resolved or are being resolved. And so, you know, my take really, though, is that we had a largely idiosyncratic problem against a backdrop of the whole system facing higher funding costs. But that was very much the intent of the Fed by raising the federal funds rate 500 basis points. I do think there was mostly an idiosyncratic situation going on.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You know, the other issue that's coming up with banks a lot these days, Seth, and admittedly, I'm kind of talking my book here a little bit. I've got a story in our Business Week magazine about this week, but it's basically the notion of deposit beta. When the Fed funds rate goes up to 5%, how quickly do banks jack up their rates that they pay on savings deposits, demand deposits especially, in reflection to how much the Fed funds rate has gone up? Because it's a really fascinating, I think, almost ahistorical whiplash that we've seen. You saw bank deposits just swell tremendously during the pandemic, something like 20% in 2020, I believe it was, and then another 10% in 2021. Now they're starting to shrink, albeit, you know, not by a ton. I think it was like 1.5% last year. But, you know, on an aggregate basis, bank deposits are shrinking. There's more competition possibly for deposits. A lot of banks are now paying above 4% on their savings rates, their deposit rates. To me, that creates a lot of questions, I think, about the financial system. You know, and warning here, I'm about to give you about a 10-part question. So stand by. But, you know, A, does that sort of deposit competition, that worriness about stickiness of deposits, have any effect on the supply of credit, do you think? And secondly, does it have any macro follow-up for the markets themselves? You know, I'm thinking if I can get 4-4.5% on my savings account at a bank, am I going to be less willing to take risk in the stock market? That sort of thing. So I'm curious how you see that whole situation playing out, both from the credit side and any other potential macro impact it might have.
Absolutely. So fascinating topic, one that is absolutely critical. So let me take a step back and think about it in a historical sense. Every time we have an interest rate cycle, business cycle, and then the Fed's moving short-term rates up and down, you see an interesting and fairly familiar pattern. When the Fed cuts rates and market rates fall, deposit rates fall along with them. And then the Fed starts to raise interest rates and deposit rates kind of lag. And then over time, that deposit beta, as you noted, starts to pick up. Big plug to my colleague, Betsy Graysek, who runs equity research at Morgan Stanley for financial institutions. She's been saying since the beginning of this hiking cycle that the deposit beta increase this time would be more dramatic than it has been in past cycles. And that's been borne out, as you've said. I think there are a few things that are a little bit different this time than previous cycles, at least recent cycles. One is the speed with which the Fed increased interest rates. We had 475 basis point rate increases this time compared to, you know, the previous couple of hiking cycles. That's a really big departure in terms of speed, and banks are having to follow up on it. Historically, though, what do you see? You see the growth rate of deposits fall, or even an outright decline in deposits, because as market rates start to go up and people can invest in treasury bills, deposits start to look a little bit less attractive, and you see that same pattern. So qualitatively, we're seeing the same thing. Quantitatively, the speed of the increase was much bigger. Key difference here is that the Fed has this reverse repo facility where they take in cash from investors and primarily money market mutual funds, and they're using that tool to help keep all market interest rates higher. That tool existed in the last hiking cycle, but that was a much more gradual hiking cycle. It did not exist in any other previous hiking cycle. And so what you can see are investors who might have otherwise had their cash in deposits at banks can now have their cash shifted over to a money market mutual fund. That money market mutual fund can put that cash at the Fed, and it's facilitating that very historical pattern of higher interest rates leading to slower deposit growth or even negative deposit growth. It's helping that process move along, but it's doing it even more effectively than historically, and again, against the backdrop of a much faster hiking cycle. So the first part of the question is absolutely yes, this shift in deposit matters. It's part of a normal hiking cycle, but it's just happening much more quickly and perhaps much more effectively than it has historically. What does it mean for other asset prices? I mean, again, usually when people talk about portfolio construction, they sort of think about what can you get on a risk-free asset, and then any other risky asset has to outperform and expand in expected value. And yeah, deposits are paying more this time around. Money funds are paying more than before. T-bills are paying more than before. My colleagues in interest rate strategy here at Morgan Stanley had put out a piece as their outlook for 2023 that was called the Year of Yield. Cash, once again, is an actual asset class. It's not just sort of where you have your wealth because you can't make up your mind yet. It's a legitimate asset class because T-bills are paying 5%. So yeah, the second part of your question, I'll also answer yes to. I think this is absolutely an important development. It matters at a macro level. It matters at a financial market level. But it is ultimately, at the end of the day, just part of how monetary policy works. But boy, the details are a little bit different this time around.
Seth, I'm also wondering if maybe there's a disinflationary aspect to this, in that if I'm somebody who puts a bunch of money in a money market fund, I'd be less inclined to actually go out and then spend it. I wouldn't have it at the ready if I wanted to buy a brand new TV, for instance.
I mean, I think that is possible. I think there's definitely the possibility that easier savings means less spending, and that makes a lot of sense. There's not always a lot of evidence in the empirical research, and it all comes down to sort of how do households weigh spending versus savings. But one thing that it clearly does is for anybody who is going to be borrowing in order to spend, the cost of funding is just going up. So we see this clearly in banks. Their cost of funding is going up, making it harder for them to lend. Households that might want to borrow in order to buy a new car, their cost of borrowing is going up because anyone who's borrowing at this point is going up. That for me is the traditionally stronger channel for monetary policy, but it could work through the savings mechanism the way you said it as well.
You know, Seth, you had mentioned those flashbacks to your days in Washington when the debt ceiling first sort of reared its ugly head and became an issue. I think as we, you know, I guess we're in the extraordinary measures phase of the debt ceiling right now. And as we get closer and closer to sort of the drop dead date, you know, there's this assumption that it's brinkmanship, that some sort of deal will be cut at the 11th hour. But I got to say, you know, politics is way more bare knuckles than I think it's ever been in my life. And I wonder if that is the wrong way to think about it this time. Do you think there is a bigger risk this time of some actual default and some serious, you know, financial risks to the whole system because of that this time?
Absolutely. I do think that the risks are bigger this time. And I think there are a few things that figure into that calculus. At the end of the day, this is a standoff, a game theoretic setting between
two sides in a negotiation. And that's, for me, part of how I think about it as an economist. But the things that are different now relative to, say, 2011 and 2013, and let's not forget, both of those episodes came basically down to the wire and were a little bit, for me at least, nerve-wracking. But now you've got different leadership in the House of Representatives, where there were, you know, lots of rounds of voting to come up with the speakership. And I think that probably changes a little bit how the calculation goes on that side. I think the other point that's very different now relative to 2011 or 2013 is that in the public domain, on the Fed's public website, are the transcripts of two different conference calls, one in 2013, one in 2011, where the FOMC discussed what would happen if we got to the point where the Treasury ran out of cash. And if you read that, you might conclude, I think wrongly from my personal perspective, but it would be easy to conclude that the Fed's got a plan and there's a way to finesse not defaulting on Treasury securities while avoiding paying on other government obligations. I'm not sure creating that potentially false sense of comfort is a good thing to get a quick and easy resolution to these sorts of things. So I do think the water has got more muddied because of the political circumstances, because of the extra information in the public domain. And you know, I worry. Maybe it's just because I'm always a congenital worrier. But we really do, in my opinion, need to see hopefully a timely resolution one way or the other.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Seth, I also want to take us abroad because you're bullish on China growth. And I'm wondering, first of all, what you're projecting in terms of China's economic growth and then how that actually is helping hold up global growth numbers, which maybe would be looking a little bit more anemic without some of the numbers that China's been posting recently.
Sure. A great topic. We are here at Morgan Stanley very bullish on economic growth for Asia in general and China in particular. We've written down 5.7% growth for China this year, which is above the official growth target from Beijing of about 5%. The data that are coming in now in terms of the rebound, first we got readings on things like mobility indexes. Now more of the data are coming in. My take is they're coming in line with that very bullish outlook for what's going on with China. And so, you know, we are sticking with our view, 5.7% growth for this year, maybe even some risk to the upside. It will, however, require that as the year progresses, as spending continues to recover, that we get more and more people brought back into the labor force, more employment gains, especially among young people. But we think that's likely to happen. And in lots of ways, that's the thesis for our outlook is first reopening coming off of a really weak level. And then as economic activity continues, it has the standard virtuous cycle, if you will, of pulling people back to work. Now, the spillover to the rest of the world, though, I think is very interesting this time. People are used to looking at past cycles where China accelerated and it helped pull the whole global economy along. This time, well, it's going to be good, presumably, for the rest of Asia, especially the parts of Asia that will benefit from Chinese tourism. But we've got some research out there that suggests that the normal spillovers from Chinese economic growth to the rest of the world, if you were to say, okay, this year, close to 3 percentage point acceleration. Can we multiply that 3 percentage point acceleration by the same coefficient we would normally use in past cycles? And the answer, I think, is no. It's probably only about half as much. And that includes the spillovers to commodities. And the reason for that is most of the growth that we're seeing in China this year is likely to be domestic spending, as opposed to a lot of the growth being fueled by exports. So that's one difference. And second, a lot of it is going to be skewed towards services instead of towards physical goods. Now, to be clear, the housing market that had been imploding is not only stabilized, it's actually starting to recover. So it's not as though this is a binary 1-0 kind of outcome. So we are getting a recovery in housing. We do think part of the fiscal policy stimulus will be through infrastructure. But boy, relative to historical patterns, a heavy skew towards spending on services. And that just means you're going to get less of a pull into China from the rest of the world than you would have in previous cycles. So we are bullish China. We're bullish Asia more generally. We think Asia outperforms, but we don't think that China is going to end up being the engine of growth for the global economy. We're looking at weak growth in the U.S. and in Europe this year.
Well, Seth Carpenter, global chief economist at Morgan Stanley, what a absolute pleasure to pick your brain like that. We really appreciate it. Can't let you go quite yet, though. We do have a tradition here on What Goes Up where we have to go over all the craziest things we've
where
seen.
Where we torture our guests.
We torture, let the torture commence.
Yes.
Yes. All right. I'm going to start for once.
Oh,
I'm going to
okay.
start.
Go ahead.
As I said, Vildana, I think you should buy a royal title.
Okay.
From the nation of Sealand. Have you ever heard of Sealand?
No.
This is great. So this is courtesy of a story in The Athletic, which is actually a sports website, but one of the best stories.
Doesn't sound like it.
how would you have ever figured? One of the best feature stories I've read about in a while. It's about the sovereign nation of Sealand, which sits 6 nautical miles off the coast of Suffolk, England. And basically what it was, in World War II, the Brits built a ocean fort. Basically, it looks like a big oil platform. It was called HM Fort Ruffs. And the idea was to have sort of defenses out in the sea to fight off the German warplanes as they came over. Some guy in 1967, a ham radio operator of all people named Paddy Roy Bates, decided he was going to take over the fort and make it the sovereign nation of Sealand. And he pretty much got away with it. He's out in the international waters. There's not much Britain can do to get it back from him. So he and his family have been living there ever since. They have a soccer team, believe it or not. The whole sovereign nation of Sealand is actually half the size of a soccer pitch. But the fascinating part is you can buy a royal title from Sealand. Baron, Baroness, Sir, Dame, Count. Countess.
Can I put it on my resume if I buy it?
Duke, Duchess? Absolutely. Absolutely. You bought and paid for it. So the question is, the lowest priced title, royal title, mind you, from the island of Sealand is Lord or Lady. So you could be Lady Vildana Heyrich of Sealand for a certain price. Now the question is, what do you think it costs to be Lady Vildana of Sealand?
I'm going to buy this, and then on next week's episode, I'm going to introduce myself as Lady Vildana Heyrich. Okay, I'm only bidding $1,000 on this.
$1,000? So
yeah.
So it's in British pounds, so that would,
oh, sorry,
that would be out of
pounds,
what, 900
yeah.
probably British pounds?
Yeah,
980
or something, I don't know.
Seth, you're now a contestant on the game show we like to call The Price is Precise. What do you think the going rate for the title of Lady of Sealand is?
All right, £1,001.
£1,001, you're going on the over, huh?
Oh, my gosh.
You guys, the King of Sealand is going to be reaching out to both of you guys, I think, because he's willing to sell one for the low, low price of £24.99.
Oh, shoot. Ooh.
So you guys are overpaying.
I almost just cursed. I overpaid, and I thought I was, but guess what? I beat Seth Carpenter in this game.
Whoa.
That's huge.
She's never going to let you hear the end of that, Seth.
I don't need to be a lady anymore.
The highest priced is Duke or Duchess. So for £1,000, you guys could be Duke and Duchess.
Duke, Duchess, lady, and
£499.
Wow.
99 pence.
That's pretty good. I wish you hadn't gone first because I actually can't compete with that. Mine is actually from my sister, who I mentioned last week, has been sending me tons of crazy things now that she's a fan of the podcast. Yeah. So again, a shout out to Morella. And she sent me this article. It's about Apple having a savings account now. And the interest rate is 4.15%.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
All right. That made its way to my Business Week story. Along with their partnering with Goldman Sachs.
Goldman, yeah.
And it sits on the wallet on your phone, which makes, I don't know if I want my entire savings sitting in my phone wallet.
Yeah, because the subway machines might steal it from you when you swipe in.
Yeah, or something. Or someone.
Because that's how it works, right?
What do you think, Seth? Are you willing to have your entire savings in your Apple wallet on your phone?
I am not, precisely because of my fear of what the subway turnstiles might be.
They're known for stealing money.
The good news is you get to ride for free for the rest of your life. The bad news is you're broke. But, it, you know, Seth, it does go to speak to this competition for deposits really heating up. I think it's, you know, so many of us had sort of written off savings accounts for so long as just, you know, a piggy bank, not really a place to earn a yield. And the times really have changed. It's pretty fascinating to watch.
It is a huge change now relative to where things have been for a while. But I like to tell some of the younger folks in the bank that I'm old enough to remember that there were even recessions when the federal funds rate didn't go down to zero. So it hadn't always been the case that savings accounts were useless. And so we're going back to normal as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair point. Fair point. Well, how about you, Seth? Do you see anything crazy these days?
You remember, I'm the global chief economist, so I look around the world, and it looks like every corner of the world has something just a little bit crazy going on. So I don't think I can narrow it down.
Fair enough. It's a crazy world all around. It's a mad world, which, well, you don't get that reference.
I do. It's a song. Is it a song?
It might be, but it's a movie.
A movie.
It's an old movie. Yeah.
Great movie, by the way. Well, Seth Carpenter, such a really an honor to talk to you and hear your thoughts about everything. I hope we can do it again someday soon.
Oh my gosh, this was great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining us. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me, at Vildana Heyrich. Mike Regan is at Reganonymous. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong, and our head of podcasts is Sage Bauman. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.